What's up, Tokyo people? Welcome to episode 14. Today we're talking about the Regulatory Reform Fire Safety Order. We're going to cover the most important articles, in my opinion, to help you manage fire safety, manage your business, and be cost effective. Okay, let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. Okay, people, welcome to episode 14, the Regulatory Reform Fire Safety Order then. Okay, so bit of news first. I think we have our first guest booked in for this podcast. Woohoo, buzz in. And a prospective second guest on the line as well. Not on the line, he's not calling in right now. I mean, in process. If you're listening to this and thinking, I really don't agree with this guy, or I really do agree with this guy, or I'd really like to have a chat with this guy, then drop me a message on LinkedIn, come find us on Twitter or Facebook, so Facebook/RiskFluent, Twitter @RiskFluent, or come find me, James McPherson, on LinkedIn, or even LinkedIn RiskFluent as well. We're on there as well. So hit us up if you want to have a chat, hit us up if you want to hear something, let us know and we will provide it onto you. Anyway, regulatory reform order then. The RRO or the FSO, depending on who you are, what you are, when you are, and what you want to call it. Either way, it is a primary piece of legislation for fire safety. So, it was born from many other pieces of legislation, the Fire Precautions Act 1961, the Fire Precautions Workplace Regulation of 1997 and /999, etc, etc, boring, boring, boring. Anyway, they took them all, they rolled them all together to create one piece of legislation, the RRO or the FSO. So, let's talk about this order then. The most important thing, I think, or maybe not the most important, but the thing where a lot of people get quite confused, especially when we start talking about domestic properties, which it does apply to, but then doesn't apply to, and that's detailed in the scope. As is anything, it's in the scope. So, why do we talk about the scope? Well, for that reason, people get quite confused easily around the scope of the RRO. So, the scope is defined in Article 6. So it says in there that this order does not apply in relation to domestic premises except to the extent mentioned in Article 31 brackets per 10, which brackets 10 means paragraph 10. So that says in this article, in quotations, premises includes domestic premises other than premises consisting of or comprised in a house which is occupied as a single private dwelling, and Article 27 powers of inspectors shall be constructed accordingly. So what does that mean? That means, in essence, guys, where there is not a common area, so therefore it's a single private dwelling, the landlord can't do anything. So it doesn't apply. That's it, simple. The common area, the RRO applies. So you own a block of flats, for example. You own a block of flats and you control the stairway and you control the corridors and you might control the plant room, something like that, if you've got communal heating systems or anything like that. Other than that, that's pretty much it. Once that flat door is closed, you do not control beyond that flat door. There is a debate amongst the fire industry and housing who owns the front door of the flat, especially when you've got like leaseholders, so they've brought like a practical freehold, so they own the lease of like 1,000 years or something like that. Stupid. There is debate around it. The way I see it is, it is difficult because it depends on the customer, and that is just a nightmare, isn't it? When you say it straight away, that's an absolute nightmare. It is really important, and I think the easiest way to resolve it is you write it into the lease, So you sell the leasehold from the front door onwards. So, you know, it begins literally from like a millimeter past the front door, in my opinion. You know, you might have some housing lease experts say that's not possible, and they're probably right, I don't know, but there's got to be a solution out there somewhere. I think we need to write into the lease that we, the landlord, own the fire door, because essentially, in my opinion, it's part of a wider shared service, the same as heating and plumbing and electrics. It's part of the overall fire strategy, which is therefore a shared service. So in my opinion, it's the landlord's duty. Landlords won't like that, because it means they might have to potentially replace loads and loads of leasehold doors. So what do you do about buildings where you've already got it and it's not written into the lease? Well, I think that's a combination of maybe some legal proceedings around the Housing Act. Maybe there is a case study going on at the moment, which we're waiting to hear from or find out what the decision is. If the decision is one way, it will set a precedent which will help us, and I think it will mean that the tenant must either consult with us, or they must do something. They must maintain the fire integrity of the door, something like that. That's what's going to come out of it. It is hard to tell. That'll be interesting to see. Anyway, moving swiftly on. So it is complicated when it comes to domestic premises, as is anything, but also some other areas that this does not include: offshore installations, ships, woods, fields and other lands forming part of an agricultural or forestry undertaking, but which is not inside a building. So basically, fields and woods and agricultural or forestry, there we go, outside the building. An aircraft, locomotive, rolling stock, trailer, semi-trailer used as means of transport, or a vehicle, a mine or a borehole site. They're the things that don't apply. So let's be honest, I'm going to guess I don't have many people that manage those listening to my podcast, but if you do, one, hit me up, I'd be really interested to talk to you. And number two, especially actually if you manage a borehole site, I would be very interested to talk to you about that. Or a mine, I'd love to talk to someone in a mine, or even a ship actually. A ship, health and safety, very particularly fire safety on a ship, maybe a submarine. That would be interesting. Anyway, I feel like I'm going off on a tangent yet again. So they're the things that don't cover. So basically, it's everywhere other than sole houses, so sole, no common area buildings, offshore installations, ships, and anything outside, fields, woods, forestry, agriculture, boom, nailed it. Aircraft, locomotives, so basically transport, mine, and a borehole site. Boom, nailed it. Easy, I don't see why it's complicated. I think people make a lot of things complicated. So what does that mean then for, let's say, a HMO? HMOs get quite confusing. I don't think they do, because HMO, the room, in my opinion, is a dwelling, and then everywhere else is a common area, because it's common with the house, so they all use it. So you own a student, student accommodation, that's a HMO in my opinion. Let's be honest, there's arguments around the description of a HMO as well. Let's just not get into that. A house of multiple occupancy is a house where multiple people occupy the house. It says it on the tin. Anyway, so it's got a common area, therefore needs a fire risk assessment. So you've got anyone out there listening to the podcast who owns HMOs, don't forget to get fire risk assessment done. Does that mean you have to go to a consultant? No. Does it mean you can educate yourself and do it yourself? Probably. But make sure you educate yourself, make sure you think about how you do it. Don't go straight to a consultant, because they will sell you a 600, 200, 300, 500, 700, I don't know how much risk assessment, and it'll be absolutely huge, and it'll blow your mind, and it'll be a snagging list, there'll be loads of things wrong. It's not that hard to manage fire safety in these areas, because it's the same as your house. The only problem is where you start to get complicated customers in there. Okay, we could argue that students are complicated customers. I hold that up. I agree. But it's not that difficult. So, moving on, because it's nearly been 10 minutes whilst I've been talking and we're not even past the scope yet. So, HMOs, domestics, they're really, really complicated sometimes, but then not complicated. So, pretty simple. I think where sometimes people can get confused as well is where there's something that's commonly referred to as a full repairing and insuring lease, full F FRI, yeah, full repair and insure, FRI lease, which basically means you do absolutely everything as the tenant. You do absolutely everything. You maintain the whole property whilst the landlord sits on his boat in Boatface, flicking pound notes off the end like Leonardo DiCaprio in Wolf of Wall Street. Essentially, that's it. He does nothing, you do everything. They're beautiful. If you're a landlord, you should be writing full repair and insurance leases. Done. Does it, though, eliminate the responsibility from the landlord? No, it does not. You still have a duty to that person, and in my opinion, you should still be checking what that person is doing. So maybe you do a 3-year audit, maybe you go and check what they're doing, maybe you just turn up, maybe you just have a good relationship with them, maybe you ask for their fire risk assessment on a regular basis just so you can see it, you know, something like that. I think there should be checks, and I think there should be checks and balances. I think it's only good for you. You're managing your asset. You know, what if they don't manage their gas boiler system, it blows up and it blows your warehouse up. I think it's sensible to do it anyway. I think common sense. Anyway, don't mention common sense. So basically, the landlord does nothing, the tenant does everything, but it does not abolish the responsibility. They still have to provide somewhere reasonable. So let's crack on with the actual piece of legislation then, even though the scope is a piece of legislation, well, part of that legislation. Anyway, waffling, moving on. Article 3. So you'll know these are called articles. I don't know why. Somebody who is really, really clever when it comes to law might be able to tell us. If they do, again, hit us up. Let me know. I am not a lawyer. And that essentially is why I'm doing this podcast, because I'm not a lawyer and I'm trying to communicate it over to you in very layman terms. So Article 3 is the meaning of responsible person. So the meaning of responsible person, for this piece of legislation essentially defines that you have to have a responsible person. So who is the responsible person then? Well, the responsible person in essence is the owner of the building, but only for what is under his control. So it varies from property to property, but the easiest way to remember is that if you own something, physically, if you own something, you have a responsibility. So if you own a service to somebody or a property and you provide that property to somebody, you have a responsibility to that person. So you've always got a responsibility. You never get rid of that responsibility. So remember that. It's just how the extent of that responsibility, and that depends on each individual situation. So really, you know, the easiest way I've always followed it is you follow the money. So if you're paid for a service, then you have a responsibility for that service. And if you're paid for somebody to rent a property, then you have a responsibility of that property. Obviously, you're renting a property, then leases start to get involved, etc. And as we've discussed earlier, it gets a little bit more complicated, but you have a responsibility. So it's normally pretty clear cut, in my opinion, but people like to overcomplicate it. So Article 4 then, what's next? Next is the meaning of general precautions. Anyway, and it basically, if the general precautions is referred to quite a lot for other documents. So, and because it's a statement, a collective statement, they've explained it for you. So basically, it's measures to reduce risk of fire, risk of spread, measures to maintain means of escape for the premises, or design means of escape for the premises. Means of escape can be safely and effectively used, measures for firefighting on the premises, detecting a fire and giving warning, measures for actions to be taken in the event of a fire, measures relating to instructions and training, and measures to mitigate the effects of fire. So in essence, it's managing the risk of fire. That's essentially the general precautions, and that's basically what it says. So really, in my opinion, there's nothing that complicated yet. There's just complicated cases where you become the nature of the service you're providing or the nature of the business you're in makes it complicated by default. But you know what, the law itself is not complicated, and I think that was kind of my overall message of why I wanted to do the law section. because the law is not complicated. It's a situation that you're in is complicated. So let's crack on. Article 5 then, duties under this order. So this is an interesting one, mainly for landlords. So where the premises are a workplace, the responsible person must ensure that any duty imposed by articles 8 to, through to 22 or by regulations made under article 24 within this order is complied with in respect of those premises. Where the premises are not a workplace, the responsible person must ensure that any duty imposed by articles 8 to 22 or regulations under article 24 is complied with respect of those premises so far as the requirements relate to matters within his control. And that's the key bit. So basically, if you own a premises or you manage premises, depending on your lease and everything, so obviously most people that have own a warehouse don't normally own the warehouse, run a business from a warehouse, they don't normally own it, they normally lease it. So normally you're the person in control, but when you're the landlord, obviously you can create that control by your lease. But when we're talking about domestic properties and domestic environment, residential environments, it becomes within your control. So that's interesting, that one is. So just remember that it's within your control. Where a person has by virtue any contract or tenancy an obligation of any extent in relation to the maintenance, repair of any premises, including anything or in or on the premises or the safety of the premises, that person is to be treated for the purpose of paragraph 3 as being the person who has control of the premises to the extent that his obligation so extends. So how what does that mean? Well, that means I always try and think a block of flats the easiest way. So the person under the tenancy has control from within the flat to within the dwelling. That is their responsibility. They are the responsible person for that area. The common area is out of their control. It's not within their control. That control is with the landlord because it's a common area. That's the real easy way to explain it. Obviously there are complicated cases in which if you have a complicated case, then you're probably going to want to hire a consultant. So in general, that's kind of part one, and that's took probably over half of what the normal allotted time for these podcasts are. So let's whiz through the rest then. So these are not all the articles, they're just some of the kind of big standout ones that will probably affect you the most. So article 8 states the responsible person must take such general precautions so far as reasonably practicable to ensure the safety of his employees and in relation to relevant persons who are not his employers, and take general fire precautions as may be reasonable, as may reasonably be required in the circumstances to ensure that the premises are safe. So essentially, you must maintain a safe building. That's literally it. You must have a safe building within reason. Article 9. So in my opinion, Article 8 is kind of a catch-all, in my opinion. And then Article 9 onwards kind of drills down to the nitty-gritty. So Article 9 then talked about the risk assessment. So essentially it puts onus on there must be a suitable and sufficient risk assessment for anyone that owns or manages a business or a property. And that's the kind of easiest way to look at this. If you provide a service where you drive round, the bit between in your transport, as we've kind of know, depending on what you're driving in, doesn't apply to have a specific fire risk assessment, but you might address fire in that person's general work risk, task-based risk assessment, or their kind of job risk assessment. And then they would ask to see the risk assessment, or should ask to see the risk fire risk assessment of the property that they go to, because their work might affect the fire risk assessment. So, you know, it's just kind of getting your head around that. And the easiest way to work around it, I think, if you're kind of doing it like that, is you would work fire into your normal risk assessment. But if you own a building or run a building or manage a building or lease a building and you operate a business from it, then you would be expected to have a fire risk assessment. So it goes into further detail around like dangerous substances and having specific steps for those dangerous substances, and it mentions that several times throughout the order. So it also talks about having to when to review those, so it reviews it when you suspect it's no longer valid or there's been significant change, so organizational change, technical change, special change, premises change, anything significant, extensions, conversions, anything like that will affect the fire risk assessment, therefore it deserves a review. So when you get these consultants come and doing a fire risk assessment and they whack a annual review onto your risk assessment, you can tell them where to go because it doesn't need that. So it's on you as a business to decide that, so on a risk-based policy, I would say. So kind of if you have multiple different versions of properties or multiple different versions of processes or something like that, then you would have a kind of tiered approach. Or as a business, you might say, well, I think we should do it every 3 years as a kind of quality check, or you know, as a given we would do it every 3 years, however we will approach the consultant when there's been significant change. Do not allow your consultant to dictate it's annually, because it's just a license to print money. They're on a cash cow, all of these people, because everybody's scared shitless about fire risk assessment. So do not let them dictate the way forward. It says don't employ young persons without considering the risk, the same as it has in Health and Safety at Work Act. And then finally it says what to record, and yet again it's exactly the same. So when you've got five or more employees, whether a license dictates that you must record it, so HMO license or alterations notice requiring this enforced in relation to the premises, you have to record the significant findings. Again, just the significant findings. So don't be writing a snagging list, and don't be doing absolutely everything, or covering, sorry, absolutely everything, because it's completely not necessary. So moving swiftly on then, Article 10 details principles of prevention. Yet again, give or take, it's exactly the same, but we're looking from the perspective of fire now. So again, we've got eliminate, replace, segregate or remove, engineer control, procedural controls and PPE. Now it does reference that differently in Schedule 1 of the order, however if you kind of drill down into it, it's essentially the same thing, it just says it differently. So if you're going to look at it from a fire point of view, to eliminate you've got to start thinking about the fire triangle. So you've got heat, oxygen and fuel, so you want to try and keep them separate, or remove one, don't remove oxygen or within reason. You might start seeing a reduction in production. Anyway, you know, replace, hard to think that maybe you're using a flammable chemical, you replace that with a non-flammable chemical if you can. Segregate, remove, so you could segregate heat sources with fuel sources. Engineer controls, so you might have automatic suppression, something like that in prayers. Procedural controls, you'll have a risk assessment, you'll have a policy, you'll have training, information, instruction. PPE is slightly different in fire, so fire extinguishers, in my opinion, are classed as first aid fire appliance, so this is a personal protective equipment. Is it personal protective equipment? It's not personal protective equipment, but I think it falls into that thing. It's a last port of call, literally the last port of call, like as you're leaving the building because the fire's licking your ass, you know, have that in hand. So that's where you would sit it. It's not the same thing, it's kind of first aid fire appliance, as it's sometimes referred to, but it falls into that area, I think. That being said, you are required to have it in one of these articles, which we will go over in a moment. Moving on then, Article 11, Fire Safety Arrangement. Basically, proportionate to your undertaking, you should have a management in place, same as Health and Safety at Work Act. So all this stuff kind of works together, they just repeat each other. So basically it's the same stuff over and over and over again. So if you can't catch you with one piece of law, they'll catch you with the other. Article 12, elimination or reduction of risk from dangerous substances. So you've got specific dangerous substances from a fire perspective, then you have specific duties to manage those so far as reasonably practicable to eliminate or remove. Article 13, the responsible person must provide appropriate, here we go, firefighting equipment and detection. Firefighting equipment's pretty easy to manage. There's quite clear British standards out there. There's a lot, to be honest, there's a lot of guidance out there. We'll, at the end of the podcast, we'll kind of point you towards some handy guidance. But when we're talking about fire detection, especially when we start talking about difference between commercial properties and domestic properties, it can get a little complicated. So the two easiest ways to work this out is the British standard, in my opinion. And when I say easy, it's still quite complicated, but and there's a lot of information out there, but the two standards that should be working to is British Standard 5839 Part 1 for commercial properties and British Standard 5839 Part 6 for domestic properties. Part 1 for commercial, Part 6 for domestic, okay? So remember that. So when, if you, especially if you're a landlord and you're listening to this, just remember that Part 6 is for the domestic properties. Now, you might get someone come and quote you Part 1 for the common areas and Part 6 for the domestic, so the dwellings, so the flats. If I'm brutally honest, it depends on the property. It's hard to gauge and it's hard to give you an answer for all. It depends again on, you know, what type of building. If we're talking like a general needs purpose-built block of flats, no, it's not required and it's not necessary. And actually, most of the time, it becomes a pain in the ass. But people kind of do it as a, they think it's the best thing, but actually, it's probably not. You know, if you've got specialist housing, it becomes a different game. It's very, very complicated, and I do feel for myself actually because I work in that industry. So, moving on. Article 15 then, so basically that just says you must have procedures for serious and imminent danger and dangerous areas. So pretty simple. If you've got anything that's serious and imminent danger, must have a procedure to control that. Article 16, emergency procedures for dangerous substances. Article 17, maintenance. You must maintain what's in your control. Again, leases can complicate this, so wherever you can, kind of whack out the full repair and insurance leases, but just if you lease a property or you are the leasee, I kind of always get these wrong way around, but there's like the leasee and the leasor. So if you're the leasee, so you're the tenant basically, just be aware of what you have a duty to maintain, what's in your control according to that lease. If you own a property and you work in that property and your business operates out of that, that's pretty simple with you. But whatever's in there, you've got to maintain it, people. It's pretty simple. It's an asset in your business, so why would you not? So if you have a lease, check it. Check that you're doing what you're responsible for doing, and just make sure your landlord's doing theirs as well. Article 18, safety assistance. So basically this is talking about hiring somebody competent. So again, this is proportionate to the risk. So somebody may be in a warehouse or a factory, you might have like an engineering manager, quite technically competent anyway because of the nature of their role. Maybe you can add on fire safety to theirs and then they work together with your existing safety professional, or maybe you've got somebody managing safety as a role and then you work fire safety onto the engineering manager, something like that. You know, that for a medium to, well, low risk property, which most of our processes are low risk nowadays, you could probably fit it like that and work it like that. But that's just one example, yeah. So don't go jumping straight to a consultant, because they will just whip out the blank check and you'll just keep writing them all the time. So just have these conversations as a team, you know, as your senior management team, all sit down together and real discuss this. Think about the law. What does it say? It says a competent person, yeah. It's all proportionate to your risk. So have a think about what you do, have a think about the risk. Fire is simple stuff, people. Yeah. So, Article 19 and 23, the provision of information to employees, and then the provision of information for people that are not your employees and everyone else, basically. So, they should, again, have suitable information. So this would be provision of like an induction or signage or anything like that. Let's be honest, the inductions, receptionists hate doing them, and people hate listening to them as well. So, you know, there's got to be some innovative ways that we can think about doing those. I've seen some pretty cool videos that you have to watch. Trick is there to not go on too long. Simple signage, you know, don't overcomplicate your fire action notices, yeah? Yeah, I've seen this a lot where they're really overcomplicated, or people move away from the kind of base standard blue signs and signals one, so they move away from that one and they go and create their own. I just think, like, it's not necessary, you know, most of the time it's not necessary. You know, if you do need a specific one, then try and keep it looking the same, so keep that kind of blue mandatory signage feel about it so that people can pick up on that. If it's a different colour, it's not ingrained in their head that that is an emergency sign or a fire action notice. Try and keep the same feel, you know, like the exclamation marks and stuff like that. Try and keep it all the same. Consistency is key. So, Article 21 then, the responsible person must ensure that their employees receive adequate training. And again, it's very similar to the Health and Safety at Work Act. So unemployment, being exposed to new or increased risk because of change of roles, change of responsibility, new equipment, new tech, new systems, etc., etc. It must be suitable and sufficient. It must be repeated periodically and adaptive to change, you know, and take place in work time. Simple stuff, all this stuff is, you know, and that's kind of what I'm whizzing over it. It's not complicated. Any of this stuff is just not complicated. And like I said earlier, it's the situations that are complicated, not the law. So if someone's going, "Oh, it's health and safety gone mad," it's not the law that's gone mad, because the law is dirt simple. It's really, really broad, and it's really, really kind of broad. Broad is the easiest way to explain it. It has to be broad. It can't be specific for everything, because everyone's so different. There is an interesting article, however, in the regulatory reform order, which I think is overlooked quite a lot. So I'll read this one out as it is written. So bear with me. If you've heard the last couple of podcasts, you know I'm not great at reading out legal terms. So let's go. Where two or more responsible persons share or have duties in respect of premises, brackets, whether on temporary or permanent basis, close brackets, each such person must A. cooperate with the other person concerned so far as is necessary to enable them to comply with the requirements and prohibitions imposed on them by or under this order. B. brackets, taking into account the nature of his activities, close brackets, take all responsible steps to coordinate the measures he takes to comply with the requirements, prohibitions, imposed on him by or under this order, with the measures the other responsible persons are taking to comply with requirements and prohibitions imposed on them by or under this order. And Jesus Christ. C. take all responsible, reasonable steps to inform the other persons concerned of the risk relevant persons arising of or in connection with the conduct of his undertaking. God, there we go, it's done. Sorry, I thought there was more, but there's not, thank God. That's it. So that's a really wordy way of saying, in my opinion, that one, you must communicate with your neighbours, essentially. It's kind of like the neighbour principle, in my opinion, in civil law. It's the same kind of thing, and it's about your effect on someone else. So you need to be aware of your effect on someone else. And in here, it's a legal duty to communicate with this person of the risk that you're undertaking poses potentially to them. So you may have a setup where you're leasing one part of a warehouse and their evacuation route is through you. You have a duty to maintain that clear route, now not just to yourself but to your neighbour as well. So you have to take reasonable steps to ensure that they can use that. You have to cooperate with them. Now let's think of this from a trying to be cost effective point of view. Here's an opportunity now. So you would read the RRO and you would think, right, I need to do a fire risk assessment for my undertaking, so for my business. So let's say we've got a massive warehouse, it's split into five, for example, right? So you would get the landlord and then each one of those business probably doing a fire risk assessment. That's six fire risk assessments for the same building. Completely nuts and over the top. It is not necessary. It's not necessary. And believe me, it happens. I've seen it over and over again, time and time again. So why don't we all work together and say, hey, why don't we just approach, because it's quite complicated, because there's five different people and there's the landlord, maybe the landlord will go and do his own, whatever, why don't we approach a consultant, get them in, and one representative from each business will escort the consultant around the business. We will talk about what we do and we'll take them through it, and we will do a fully comprehensive fire assessment for the building together as one. More cost effective, one bill, not five. Simple stuff. So that is kind of the main bulk of it. There is one notable mention, Article 38, maintenance of measures provided for the protection of firefighters. Basically, building owners, you have a duty to maintain anything that the fire service might use or it might present a risk to them. So wet risers is a good example. If you know what they are, great. If you don't, they're essentially pipes in a building that go all the way up the top so that the fire service can pump water from the bottom all the way up the building with an outlet at each floor. If you live in a block of flats, a high-rise block of flats, you'll probably see a little red square rectangle with a weak glass on it and then a sign with a little red flame on it. That's a dry riser. So you have to maintain that. If you don't maintain it, it needs servicing like once a year. So that's it. It's not nothing crazy. If you don't maintain that, the fire service turn up to use it, it doesn't work, you are massively liable, not just to your customers now, but to the firefighters as well. So bear that in mind. Compartmentation. You know, if you provide a stay put policy, for example, in a block of flats that's not suitable for that block of flats, so it's a converted property, it's not purpose built, then you're putting the firefighters at risk, not just your customers at risk. If you don't maintain compartmentation of a purpose built block that operates stay put policy, for example, then you again have a duty to the firefighters, not just the customers. Fire evacuation lifts. Firefighters will use said lifts. You know, just think about these things. You know, if you own blocks of flats as well, not that I think, I probably don't have any housing associations listening to this or people that own blocks of flats, but anyway, just in case, you know, having control of those common areas within reason, some of the stuff that's in there might pose a risk to the fire service. So you've got to think about that as well. So let's close this out then, because we've gone over the normal allotted time. So we cover quite a lot, have whizzed over them. You know, there's 53 articles and 5 schedules in this order. They're all massive documents, but they're legal documents, guys. So there's a lot of words, but when you drill down into it, there's one golden thread. And that golden thread is a couple of words like adequate, suitable, sufficient, as far as reasonably practicable, etc., etc. You know, these mean, in my interpretation, that it's proportionate to the risk, it's proportionate to your business, and it's the same thing for all of these regs. You know, so who decides that? It's you. You decide that. You decide if you're competent. You decide if it's proportionate to the risk. How do you find out if that's good enough? Well, you really and truly find out when you're in court, because when you're in court, you didn't do enough. And that unfortunately, that's the downside of it. Good is expected of you and bad is punished. So that's the downside of it. However, there are other ways to find out. You know, let's work a bit more collaboratively with our stakeholders, with our competitors, you know, with consultants. You know, consultants do have a role to play in this. They really, really do. But not how they're being utilized at the moment, where it's just give it to a consultant, they'll go and do it. They hand you this copy and paste fire risk assessment and then they bugger off and send you an invoice 2 weeks later. That's not how they need to be used, but then they can be used with, you know, consulting. They get the luxury of seeing so many different industries and so many different ways of working that they can be that gold mine that you need, or that kind of sense check to see if you're doing things right. So get them in to have a look at how you're doing things from a broader perspective, but be open and honest with them. But firstly, when you get them in, say, you're not here, to produce me a copy and paste snagging list fire risk assessment. You're here to tell me if you think what I am doing and the decisions I've made are proportionate and practical and reasonable and sufficient and suitable and adequate to the risk and to the law. That's it. But be blunt with these people and know your stuff as well. Don't be like me when my boiler broke the other week and the plumber's going, who's a friend of mine, so hopefully he's not listening, but the plumber's going, I really think you should replace it, mate, not fix it. And the only thing I had to go on was my trust of this person. And luckily, as I say, he was a friend, so I did trust him. But he could have been leading me down the garden path, because it was easier, cheaper, and a bigger profit margin for him to replace the boiler. I doubt that, because he's a friend, but it could have been the case. Same as when you go take your car to the garage, you want to see what's going on. You want to see the tyre when he says, oh, you need to replace the tyre, mate. All right, cool, I want to see the old one. You want to have a base knowledge of this stuff. So that's what I'm saying. When you go and get a consultant, try and get a bit more information first so you know what you're going on about. So where can you get this guidance? Well, the Department of Local Governments and Communities produce some really good guidance around fire risk assessment. So they cover all matters of areas. So each kind of area that I'll list them off for you, but each area has its own guidance. It doesn't cover everywhere. And just be cautious to look at the scope, but And I'll go into why in a second, but let's just read out which ones there are. So there's offices and shops, factories and warehouses, sleeping accommodation, residential care properties, educational properties, small and medium places of assembly, brackets holding 300 people or less, large places of assembly holding more than 300 people, theatres, cinema and similar premises, open air events and venues, healthcare premises, animal premises and stables, transport premises and facilities. So pretty much, guys, you know, that's a lot of properties there. And actually, there's guidance there that works quite closely with this piece of legislation. So this essentially, these are your ACOPs of fire. So why did I say bear in mind the scope? Well, from, let's take for example the sleeping accommodation one. So it could be deemed that the sleeping accommodation one is all domestic and residential properties. No, unfortunately not. It does get very complicated around which guidance applies to which property, because there's such a variety of properties out there. It does get complicated, so just be very cautious to read the scope. If you are in a residential property game, I would probably advise finding a good consultant and having a good relationship with that consultant. Do not assume that 10 years service in the fire service is competency. Depends where they came from in the fire service. Depends what they did in the fire service. Do not assume that being an accredited member of the Institute of Fire Risk Managers or the Institute of Fire Engineers is an automatic badge for competency. Ask to see some of the risk assessment. Ask to see case studies. Then go and get a new case study yourself. Go and ring these people for testimonials and say, hey, you used Bodyplot. How was it? You know, you're still not going to be able to guarantee it, but you'll have a better idea. So essentially, guys, that's it. We got a couple more episodes coming around law, maybe just one more, maybe two, I'm not sure. I've got one on the books, which hopefully we'll have a guest on to talk about with as well, and then maybe one more, but we just want to cover the main big ones, and then probably back on to the normal stuff. So that's it. Thanks for listening, guys. Peace out. Be safe. Bye-bye.